coup or not a coup today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. The military in Zimbabwe takes control of the country, and President Robert Mugabe is confined to his home. But the military wants to make one point clear.
We wish to make it abundantly clear that this is not a military takeover.
So, not a coup, then.
It seems very clear that President Mugabe is now just a president in name, and authority is now residing in the military.
We'll try to sort out all of that. Also, the story of two young Somali poets who met on a commuter train here in Boston.
Since I was super quiet, I would be writing.
And she was just writing, and I'd go and bother her. And she was like, okay, now your turn. You have to write a poem.
Those stories plus Germany's nagging coal problem today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We start in the past today to better understand the present. Spin back to 1980, 37 years ago, and a new leader coming to power in Zimbabwe. Cannon fire and a Bob Marley concert. That's a fanfare that greeted Robert Mugabe's ascent to power 37 years ago. Now, this is what Zimbabwe has come to.
To both our people and the world beyond our borders, we wish to make it abundantly clear that this is not a military takeover.
An apparent coup on the streets of Harare and a major general from the Zimbabwe Defense Forces denying that any coup has taken place. Meanwhile, Robert Mugabe, now 93 years old, is reported to be safe but confined to his home. So how are people in Zimbabwe reacting to the developments?
People were not celebrating openly, but talking to people who were standing outside banks, people going about their business, there was a general sentiment that they were not opposed to the coup.
Farai Musaka is a reporter with the Associated Press. We reached him in Zimbabwe's capital, Harare.
There are some military vehicles and soldiers stationed at strategic points, for example, the road leading to parliament, the road leading to President Mugabe's office. But otherwise, it's calm, it's quiet. People have been going about their normal business.
Were there any parts of the military that remained loyal to Mugabe and opposed this takeover?
At this moment, there are no signs that there is any part of the military that is loyal to Mugabe, because it seems that the military is united in the stance taken by its command.
I mean, that is pretty extraordinary. After 30-something years in power, nobody is going to oppose the removal of this man from office. Just give us a reminder of the political backdrop for what happened. When did all this start?
The friction between the president and the military has been brewing for some months now, especially because of the choice of his successor. When the military thought that he was going to choose his wife ahead of their own preferred candidate, then they moved him.
Yeah, so is that what it all kind of boils down to, that Mrs. Mugabe, Grace Mugabe, otherwise known as Gucci Grace to some people who are critics of her, the idea that she might become the next president, was that kind of the tipping point for the military?
That was the tipping point. Remember last week, she openly said that she had asked the president to hand over power to her. At the same time, this was the time that the military's preferred candidate was being fired from both the government and the ruling party. And from then on, it became open war between the president and his wife and the military on the other hand.
One last question. The vice president, Emmerson Mnangagwa, who was sacked last week, he fled to South Africa. Is he going back to Zimbabwe now? And what role could he play in any new government?
What we hear is that he indeed is coming back. And also what we're hearing is that he might want to play a leading role in the transition, era. So, and he is looking forward to taking an inclusive approach. That means they are also talking to the opposition to try and see what role it can play. So it's an idea of trying to be inclusive, getting in people who were opposed to Mugabe, and then him leading that transition.
Farai Mutsaka is a reporter for the Associated Press. He joined us from Harare.
Mugabe may still be trying to negotiate his exit rather than, you know, just getting tossed out. He may still be talking to the Zimbabwean generals. He may still be talking to Jacob Zuma and say, well, these are the terms by which I will exit.
That's reporter Andrew Meldrum. He lived and worked in Zimbabwe for more than two decades. In 2003, the Mugabe government expelled him after he reported on state torture. Meldrum now lives in Johannesburg and says a lot still hangs in the balance in Zimbabwe.
It's not clear who's going to lead Zimbabwe after Mugabe and what kind of government it's going to be. There are many people who are very hopeful that it's going to be an inclusive democracy that restores Zimbabwe's economic prosperity and respects human rights. There are other people who say, well, it may be ruled by the generals and it's going to be more of the same and that things won't be wildly different from under Mugabe. This is a coup that is trying to look more transitional than like a strongman.
What makes you feel it's a transitional coup? What have you seen so far?
Well, certainly the way the generals are speaking. And also, I think we're seeing Jacob Zuma and other South African officials get involved. We're seeing neighboring countries of the Southern African Development Community, SADC, get involved. And, they're committed to good governance. And so this is what they are trying to encourage, is a return to constitutional rule within days of it being overtaken by the military.
And then there's Robert Mugabe's wife, Grace, whose sudden ascent to power seems to be what really angered the military and prompted action yesterday. Allegedly, she's fled the country, maybe to Namibia. You were there the day she married Zimbabwe's president, not Mugabe's first wife. You've watched her rise to power. What do you think? Is she likely to exit the political stage quietly?
Yes, I do think so. I mean, she may take her money and run. On the other hand, you know, she has been Robert Mugabe's chief caretaker. And, I think really she rose to political power in the past few years because she controlled all access to her aging husband. And so that became the gates to power. Maybe she will want to stay, but, you know, on the other hand, maybe she will think it's not safe to stay. And also, of course, she has children. She has a daughter who's living in Hong Kong. She has two sons who are living in Harare. So, there's that to think about as well.
So you're there in Johannesburg, South Africa. What role is South Africa attempting to play at this point?
Jacob Zuma, who is enmeshed by corruption scandals here, is able to step up and say, well, he wants to be a regional statesman. He wants to have a calm and a orderly transition in Zimbabwe, and he's sending up his cabinet ministers to try and negotiate that. So this is something that I think he wants to be seen to be doing.
So some Zimbabwe human rights activists are guardedly optimistic, guardedly. No one is expecting Zimbabwe's police state to crumble, but might there be an opening now for democratic forces in the country?
Well, I think that we are, ushering in, as much as the generals and South Africa and, of course, the recently fired Vice President Emmerson Mnangagwa, I think they would all like to have a controlled transition. But once you open this door, once there is a crack, a wedge, maybe civic organizations, human rights organizations, Zimbabwe's opposition, they may all work together and try and push and force the door open and actually force in a truly democratic change rather than just a controlled transition.
Andrew, you were in Zimbabwe for two decades. What is the best illustration you can recall of how power operates there?
You know, when I first came to Zimbabwe in 1980, that was in the flush of Zimbabwe's, the end of white minority rule. And it was all very positive and anything was possible. And if you had interchange with the police, if you spoke well, people would speak to you well, and you could have a discussion about things and things could be sorted out. By the time I left in 2003, by the time I was thrown out in 2003, it had become a state where there were roadblocks. I was standing by my car, at 11:30 at night with an AK-47 wielding policeman, and it was much more sinister.
Andrew Meldrum with the AP speaking with us from Johannesburg, South Africa. Thanks very much, Andrew.
Thanks, Marco.
We've been hearing for months now about the crackdown in Myanmar against the Rohingya people. The Rohingya are a Muslim minority in this Buddhist majority country, and they've been the target of brutal attacks by Myanmar's security forces. Nearly a half million people have fled across the border into neighboring Bangladesh and telling stories of murder, arson, and mass rape. Myanmar's leaders say their military campaign is a response to a Rohingya rebellion. The UN calls the Myanmar security operation ethnic cleansing. Today we have a story of two Rohingya refugees who just arrived here in Boston this week. Here's my WGBH colleague, Gabriella Emanuel.
Less than 12 hours after landing at Logan Airport, Mohammed Anwar and Hussein Mohammed are sitting on folding chairs in their Dorchester apartment. It's undecorated and sparsely furnished. Across the well-worn table is their caseworker, Rahmatullah Akka. He's just pulled out his cell phone.
Hello?
Hey, I'm ready.
Yeah. Good. Yeah, so we might need your help with translation today. I put it in loudspeakers. They're listening.
There's a problem. The translator speaks the wrong language, Burmese, not Rohingya. But luckily, Akka is himself a refugee, having arrived 2 years ago from Afghanistan. And he happens to speak Urdu.
Do you speak Urdu? Can I speak with you in Urdu?
Urdu seems to work, so they get started.
May aapka case worker who?
Akka explains everything in the third-floor apartment these two men share with four other refugees, all Muslim men. They pause at the front entrance. Akka shows them how to unlock the door to their new home. It's been a long journey to get here. It started in Myanmar, where the two men lived in distant villages. For decades, the Rohingya have been denied citizenship and basic rights in Myanmar. And Mohammed says at times violence consumed his village.
2012, 2015, 2017.
In those years, Mohammed says Myanmar's military attacked them, indiscriminately killing community members. He particularly remembers seeing people, even children, thrown alive into fires. Both Anwar and Mohammed fled by boat in 2015 without their families. When the men eventually reached Indonesia, they shared a room in a refugee camp for a few years.
It's a terrible, terrible world tragedy right now.
Jeff Thielman is the CEO of the International Institute of New England, the group resettling Anwar and Mohammed.
What's going on in Myanmar right now is just like Rwanda. It's practically a genocide. That is what is happening right now, and we should do something about it as a country.
Several European countries and a UN official have called the situation ethnic cleansing. But on his brief five-hour visit to Myanmar, U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson wouldn't go that far.
Whether it meets all the criteria for ethnic cleansing, I think we continue to evaluate that ourselves.
Tillerson called for an independent investigation. But Nazda Alam of Weston, Massachusetts, isn't waiting for that investigation.
Feel like it is our human consciousness and responsibility to help.
Alam has been in the U.S. for more than three decades. She's originally from Bangladesh, which is hosting hundreds of thousands of Rohingya refugees. Alam worries the international outcry has been muted because of their religion.
A lot of time you will see the headline, Rohingya Muslim, Rohingya Muslim. But we don't want to see that. This is a human rights issue. It's not Muslim issue.
Alam has teamed up with others to send doctors and supplies to the refugee camps. She's also focused on political action, pushing federal legislation that would, among other things, impose sanctions on certain officials in Myanmar and limit the U.S. from military cooperation with the country's army. As for Mohammed Anwar and Hussein Mohammed, they're busy with the logistics of starting their lives in America, buying cell phones, signing up for emergency food assistance. And they're already thinking about the future, the possibility of one day bringing their families over and getting citizenship, something they were denied in Myanmar. For the World, Gabriella Emanuel, Boston.
Coming up, another story from right here in Boston. Two young Somali poets who met by chance on a commuter train. You're with the World. Marco Werman here. You're with the World. We're going to talk about Somalia now, but not in the way Somalia often gets described in the headlines. You know, the country in the Horn of Africa, site of violence and poverty. Our focus on the world today is on Somalia, a country known for its poetry. And when Somalis leave their homeland and settle here in the U.S., that poetry does not get left behind. Here's Ian Koss with the story of two young women, poets, keeping a family tradition alive.
When she was a little girl, Amal Hussein loved listening to her grandmother perform gabe. That's a style of Somali poetry.
I remember I didn't even understand some of the words, but just the flow, the rhythm, the drums, the beat, everything, like you're literally inside the gabe.
She wanted to learn to write gabe too. There was just one problem. Amal grew up in Boston. Her family came here when she was three, but her grandmother stayed behind.
She lived through when Somalia was really beautiful and peaceful, and then she lived through the civil war. And when we left, she didn't want to come. She was always like, this is my sand. This is where I feel like is home.
How long would you talk on the phone?
Hours. It was hours. And she would tell me stories on how she learned the gabe.
The way Amal talks about her grandmother, it's like she's here.
You know how everyone has their grandmother like in the house, and it's like I've had that feeling through the phone, which is pretty amazing. Every time I went and I spoke to her, she'd always tell me things that I need to hear rather than things that I want to hear. So she was always like my backbone in a way.
Amal grew up hearing poetry in the house, but she never dared write her own until she met Hamdi, Hamdi Mohammed.
That's Hamdi. It's Hamdi's the writer.
They met at an Islamic middle school in a suburb south of Boston. They're the only two Somali girls at the school, and every day they rode the train there together, an hour each way. Here's Hamdi.
Since I was super quiet, most of our Camino Real rides in the beginning, well, I didn't know her that well. I would just be reading a book about myself or something like that. Oh, I'd be writing.
And she was just writing, and obviously, like, I'd go and bother her and see, like, what she was writing. And, like, she was like, okay, now your turn. You have to write a poem.
And I did kind of force her to write it, too, because she was also forcing me to do things so out of my comfort zone.
As it turned out, Hamdi's grandmother was also a poet. And soon, the two girls were writing poetry together.
So we would like come up with a different topic, and then we would just write like silently.
And then I'll give her the paper, and she'll finish it, or I'll finish it at the end. But that cycle can keep going on and on and on, just like gabe in a way.
The land of unbroken horizons.
The land of golden camels and slanted trees.
The land of red dust and memories.
The land of unsi and spices.
The land of halwa and shah.
Then you hear the like train stop, and you're like, oh, okay. And then you get up, and then you go back to the real world. So.
At first, Hamdi and Amal wrote all their poems in English. But then a few years ago, Amal decided she would write a poem in Somali, no matter how long it took. She wrote it with one person in mind.
So I got off the phone with my grandma, and right away I'm like, okay, I'm going to write a Somali poem.
The poem was only 7 lines long, but that's more of a challenge than you might think.
You know how there's like regular English, and then there's like poetic English, like William Shakespeare. It's like that.
And gabe is not just free-form poetry. It's more like a sonnet if we're talking Shakespeare, where all the words have to fit in the right timing.
So whenever I write, I always have this rhythm. And it's the rhythm my grandma always used when she was reading her poetry.
And the meaning can't be too obvious. You have to tuck it into metaphors and proverbs.
And I remember calling my grandma, and like she would listen to it. It's a warning. Like, I'm talking to all the Somali people that fled away from Somalia in a way. We're exiled from our own country. Well, at first she didn't talk. She was just really silent. She started crying. And then she was like, you're definitely my granddaughter.
When was that conversation?
That was, I believe, like 3 years ago. So it was like a year before she passed away. We all knew she was sick. So I made sure I spoke to her often, and because my Somali name is Mumtaz, so she'd always say, "Oh, Mumtaz, the poet." You know, that was like one of my last memories with her.
Both Amal and Hamdi hoped to make the trip to Somalia in the next year. And for Hamdi, at least, her grandmother is still around, living in Kenya at the moment, and waiting to see her granddaughter again after many years apart. Hamdi is working on a translation of her own poem called For My Ayeyo, which means For My Grandmother. Hamdi hopes to speak the poem to her in person and in Somali.
I feel heavy, Ayeyo, when we speak on the telephone. My memory of your hands are fading. Henna we used to wear, black and red, now gone. Make a prayer, Ayeyo, with your long black prayer beads. God is closer to you than I. I am coming soon, Ayeyo. Listen for my skin and bones. They always know where they came from.
Ian's story is an excerpt from the podcast The New American Songbook about immigrant artists and musicians. It's produced with support from the Ground Truth Project here at WGBH and Mass Humanities. And we'll have more poetry on the show tomorrow, a story about Bohemian poet Celia Dropkin. Dropkin was born in what is today Belarus, but lived in New York for much of her life. Her poems are in Yiddish, which may account for her relative obscurity. About 15 years ago, though, three people in a Yiddish language class decided to do something about that. They went out and translated Dropkin into English. Faith Jones, Sam Solomon, and Jennifer Cronovit.
Back then, Sam was a teenager.
I was still at high school. I had one more year coming along.
And Faith was a librarian for the New York Public Library.
I turned 35 that summer.
There was a decade between each of us, and I was in the middle. Through the years of translating Dropkin, Sam was the one who argued most passionately to stay true to Dropkin's Yiddish.
Because her Yiddish is very spare. It's not especially full of jokey idioms or things that people associate with Yiddish in America.
The poems of Celia Dropkin, now in English. That's tomorrow on The World. And still ahead today on the show, we'll get back to our top story, the apparent coup in Zimbabwe. The country's 93-year-old president, Robert Mugabe, is reportedly confined to his house. That is a long way from the moment Mugabe took power nearly four decades ago.
There's an enormous amount of hope invested in Robert Mugabe. I remember my history teacher, dear old Mrs. Butler, my mentor in many ways, being much more skeptical and saying, you know, let's just wait and see what happens at the next elections in 4 years' time.
The history behind today's headlines, that's coming up here in a few minutes. I'm Marco Werman. So what if President Trump pulls the U.S. out of trade and climate deals, attacks the press, and warms up to authoritarian leaders?
I guess our fear is that he is accelerating the relative decline of an American-led Western order by a generation.
David Rennie of The Economist sizes up Trump. That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Presidents travel around the globe, some more, some less, but international trips are part of the ritual for every White House administration. The point is to showcase American leadership and influence, and to reassure our allies that America is engaged with the world. Today, President Trump described his just-concluded 12-day, five-country tour of Asia in exactly those terms.
During our travels, this is exactly what the world saw. A strong, proud, and confident America.
But my next guest, David Rennie of The Economist, says there's no hiding the fact that America under Trump has turned inward and is losing influence around the globe. David, thanks for being here. It's been a year since Trump was elected, and there were some really dire predictions about what America would do to foreign relations with any number of countries. Have these dire predictions come true, David?
No, some of the worst dire predictions came from Donald Trump as a candidate. If he had just done what he promised or threatened to do, he could have pulled out of NATO by now. He could have threatened American membership of the United Nations. Those really extreme scenarios haven't happened. So there is a camp in Washington, often Republicans in Congress, trying to see the best in this, who say you know, maybe he might be an accidental Ronald Reagan. You know, maybe he's a bit rough around the edges, but actually a lot of these allies are freeloaders. America needs to be a bit tougher, needs to be more respected. So actually, Trump's got a point, and he hasn't started any new wars, and he hasn't pulled out of the WTO, and so he hasn't started a trade war with China. So, you know, that's the optimistic vision. I think we, the economists, think, yes, the worst has not come to pass, but actually, if you believe that a strong America engaged with the world is a valuable thing, and we do, there's a lot to worry about.
I mean, I saw Senator Charles Schumer say about Trump's trip to Asia that every American should be embarrassed. What did you see during that trip, those 12 days?
Well, as ever, when you're looking at American politics, it depends which Americans you're talking about. I mean, the half of the country that broadly supports what President Trump is doing, they saw a president being treated with fantastic amounts of pomp and flummery by the Chinese or the Japanese or the Vietnamese. He announced a lot of deals where the Chinese were going to buy lots of airplanes, other people were going to buy lots of weapons. And so if you're naturally a Trump supporter, you look at that and you think, great, this guy is doing exactly what he promised. The problem is that the half of America that isn't quite so sure about this program, if they were paying attention, we think they'll have seen some shocking things. So Donald Trump appeared on the same press conference platform as the president of the Philippines, Rodrigo Duterte, who's not just a kind of bad guy, but boasts about being a killer, has a program of essentially extrajudicial killings where death squads under his command are going around the country killing a lot of people. That normally would have got you some sort of rebuke from an American president. Donald Trump is not just not interested in talking about human rights in some kind of realpolitik way, he actually praises Duterte, says what a great guy he is, what a great relationship they had. And there was this awful moment where Duterte was shocked at the idea that he might be asked to take questions from the press, said that the press were spies and kind of enemies, and Trump laughed, because that's also Donald Trump's rhetoric about the press. And that's new. That's really new.
So how long do you think this Trump effect will impact American foreign policy? I mean, I was speaking with people attending the climate conference in Bonn, and they're looking at 2020 when Trump may or may not be out of office. That's when things will change. I mean, is that how long this is going to last?
Look, if there are listeners out there thinking, oh, you know, this is some guy from The Economist, you know, typical sneering at Trump, why don't they get it that, you know, America needs to put itself first and other countries, they know that they have to deal with America and it'll be the same. Nothing's really changed. Some big things are changing. Look at the fact that while Donald Trump was in Asia, other Asian allies signed a giant trade deal among themselves at the level of 11 countries that was designed to be at the level of 12 countries and was built around the 12th, which was America. And they didn't want to do this 11. And you saw the Prime Minister of Australia, Malcolm Turnbull, saying, we've designed this so that America can one day plug back in. So they are looking after their own interests reluctantly without America and trying to design these structures so that a better American government can come back and be normal again.
So earlier, David, you said that The Economist believes that there is a lot to worry about with foreign policy and Trump. What specifically? Like, what's at the top of your list?
Well, if you create a vacuum, others will fill it. And you can look down a checklist of items where Donald Trump pulling back from an American leadership role on things like climate change, on things like free trade, on things like a rules-based order, on support for civil society, for a free press, for human rights, all the things that, for better or for worse, American presidents have defended. The fact that he now scorns them, the fact that he mocks them, that he praises enthusiastically strongmen whose hands are dripping with blood. Even if Donald Trump passes from the scene and you get another American president, I guess our fear, to put it at its simplest, is that he is accelerating the relative decline of an American-led Western order by a generation.
David Rennie of The Economist, always good to speak with you. Thank you.
Thank you.
As we just heard, one of the areas the U.S. has retreated from in international leadership is on climate change. So at the UN climate talks in Bonn this week, all eyes are on Europe and China to see how much they step up to push the Paris Climate Agreement forward. But here is a sobering thought. Even if every country that signed on to the deal keeps its promise to cut emissions, the world is still not on track to meet the overall goal to keep global warming below a 2 degrees Celsius increase. So just how far off are we? Anders Lieberman is a climate scientist at the Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research and joins us from the Bonn Talks via Skype. Let me turn that question over to you, Anders. How far off are we from that 2-degree goal?
Well, at the moment, even if we kept our promises, we would reach 3.5 degrees. That is lower than the 5 degrees that we would get if we don't do anything. But in fact, the actual track that we are on is rather the 5 degrees track.
Why 2 degrees Celsius? I mean, I know that's something of an arbitrary number that, you know, a lot of people came to agreement on. But what are the tipping points, like important tipping points we can avoid if we stay below 2 degrees Celsius?
Well, we are already at 1 degree, 1.2 degrees, something like this. So there's inertia in the climate system, which tells us that we really can't achieve below, for example, 1.5 degrees or even lower, because we have already passed this in a sense. So the next target is 2 degrees. And already at 2 degrees, we know that the Arctic will be ice-free in summer. I don't know how it is with you, but I grew up with the idea of perpetual ice on both poles. That won't be the truth anymore. The American Santa Claus has to find another place to live, right? All the coral reefs on the planet will already be dead with 2 degrees. And beyond 2 degrees, the world gets worse. The polar vortex is going to come more and more often to the United States. Weather extremes will intensify all over the place. And we live in a globalized world. So even weather extremes in other parts of the world affect us in Europe and the U.S.
So you are among a group of scientists who argue that to make this 2-degree target possible, global emissions have to start getting lower and lower beginning in just 3 years, 2020. What is important about 2020?
Well, 2020 is important because this is the point where we have to reach the peak in global emissions. And then it has to go down. And then we actually have to reach zero emissions by the second half of the century and then produce some way of producing negative emissions. If we wait longer than 2020, then we have to go down faster afterwards. And eventually we'll have to get the CO2 back out of the atmosphere. And we at the moment have no technique that can actually achieve this on the scale that we would need it if we wait beyond 2020.
So if we don't start reducing emissions by 2020, you're saying it just gets really, really difficult, maybe even impossible to get to that 2-degree Celsius goal.
That is true, yes.
How worried are you with this target being set and then people just giving up if the world misses 2 degrees Celsius?
Well, people won't give up at 2 degrees simply because they will feel increasingly the pressure from nature, if you like. You felt it this year in the United States with a major hurricane season. So people will feel the climate changing more and more dramatically.
So you're there in Bonn. Are you optimistic we can get to 2020?
I'm optimistic. And you know why? We are very bad at predicting economic revolutions, and we experience an economic revolution at the moment. The solar power panels are getting cheaper and more efficient at the same rate as computer chips have done in the past. I'm not really counting on politics to determine the pace of this transition. Politics are just supposed to set the targets and say this is where we need to be, and then the economy will use its power to get us there.
Climate scientist Anders Lieberman speaking with us from Bonn. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
One politician who's long tried to push us to where we need to be on climate is German Chancellor Angela Merkel. Her message today at the summit in Bonn, the Paris Agreement must be just the beginning of the serious global fight against climate change. She added that daily global events show us how urgent this is. Germany's also become a leader in developing green energy, but there is a darker side to the country's climate story as well. Here's reporter Valerie Hamilton.
Just outside of Cologne in western Germany, about 40 miles from where UN climate delegates are meeting this week, there's a 12,000-year-old forest, a vast leafy cathedral of beech and oak. It's pretty quiet, except for the rustle of dead leaves underfoot and the occasional songbird, but it turns out it's a great place to get an earful about Germany's vaunted climate leadership.
Germany is not the greenest country in the world, far not.
This is a guy who calls himself Tom, and he's just come down from a treehouse.
It's one of the biggest CO2 producers in the world. What we have here basically is the best country in greenwashing.
Tom is one of dozens of climate activists who are tree-sitting here in the Hambach Forest. You can barely hear it, but right up against the edge of the forest, there's a huge open-pit coal mine. It's one of the largest of its kind in the world, and there are plans for it to get bigger, swallowing the forest and a town nearby to get at the brown coal or lignite underneath. People like Tom have been literally camping in the trees for 5 years now to try to keep that from happening. Tom says it's not just about saving the trees. It's about saving the planet.
I am not demanding this. The f***ing planet is demanding this. It is necessary. If we want to stop or reverse climate change, we have to stop the brown coal as soon as possible.
This may come as a surprise, but Germany still burns a lot of coal. 40% of its electricity still comes from coal-fired power plants. That's a bigger percentage than in the United States. And most of that is brown coal, one of the dirtiest fossil fuels. Germany mines more brown coal than any country on Earth.
It's awkward because we Germans claim we're going to be the climate champions. And on the other hand, we have the largest share of brown coal in our electricity mix.
Timon Wainert is a researcher at the state-funded Wuppertal Institute, a climate think tank. To be fair, he says, Germany is transforming its energy sector. It already gets a third of its electricity from renewables, and it's shooting for 80% by mid-century. But for now, it's way behind on its goal of cutting carbon pollution 40% from 1990 levels by 2020.
If you really want to achieve our climate targets, we need to phase out coal.
But even here, that's been a tall order. Coal has been a source of domestic fuel, jobs, and pride for decades. Thousands of people still work in mines like Hambach. They're not in a hurry to see it gone. And there's something else going on that few people saw coming.
The market is not driving out coal, but the risk is that the market is driving out gas.
The market is Germany's wholesale electricity market, and it's been upended by the country's big increase in renewable energy. That surge has pushed prices down, and it's made electricity from imported natural gas relatively expensive. Gas is cleaner, but domestic brown coal is cheaper. The pit at the Hambach mine is so big that standing at one end, you can't see the other. 33 square miles of brown, like a giant dirty sandbox. The huge machines digging in the middle look like insects buzzing in the distance. On the horizon, smoke pours from coal-fired power plants. It's quite a sight. And there's an overlook for people who come to see it, with a playground and a cafe. That's where I meet a group of older women drinking coffee. They didn't want to give their names, but they had plenty to say.
Nee, das soll weniger werden.
We need to use less of it, says one. It's dirty. The others lay into her. We still need it. What's the alternative?
Die sollen sie uns mal zeigen, die Alternative.
It's a debate that's happening all over Germany.
Public opinion has pretty much changed.
Bill Hare runs the Berlin-based research group Climate Analytics. 15 years ago, Hare says, you couldn't even talk about phasing out coal.
You know, it was almost a taboo subject.
No longer. Coal still has its partisans, but a majority of Germans say it's got to go. And now Chancellor Angela Merkel's government says it agrees. Sort of. Ahead of September's elections, Merkel's party for the first time promised a coal phase-out, but without setting a date. Now she's trying to form a government with Greens and Liberals, and coal policy is a big sticking point in the talks. Hare says it's an awkward moment to be hosting the COP23, the UN climate conference, but maybe a helpful one.
The international community is creating pressure on the negotiations, and I'm hoping that the COP does actually move this forward in a positive way.
It might, and it might not. The Greens want to start closing coal plants now. The other parties are shying away from deadlines, but they are talking about it.
In this system, for sure, this is, you could call it progress.
Back in the Hambach forest, Tom, the tree sitter, says he understands that big changes can take time.
We know that technically there's not a big switch that you turn off and then everything is gone. We know that everything is a process, but we see that we are running out of time.
The climate may well be running out of time. The forest here definitely is. Later this month, the mining company is coming for its next bite of land, and the tree sitters will have to decide whether to stay and fight or find a new platform for their protest against Germany's appetite for coal. For The World, Valerie Hamilton, Hambach Forest, Germany.
I'm Marco Werman with The World, and back to our top story today, the apparent military coup in Zimbabwe, which the army there denies is a coup. But the fact is, the country's longtime president, Robert Mugabe, spent today under house arrest. And it's possible that we're seeing the end of his remarkable 37 years in power, or as I saw online today, Zimbabwe may be able to finally say after nearly four decades that it has a former president. The World's History guy, Chris Wolf, has been following Mugabe's career since the 1970s, and that would make it actually before he became president, before Zimbabwe became Zimbabwe. It was still Rhodesia. Why this interest in the country for you, Chris?
As a kid, I was obsessed with military history, Marco, and the only place in the world where British-type people were fighting was in Rhodesia, which was what Zimbabwe was called in colonial times. And I say British because pretty much all the white settlers had come from Britain in the 20th century, so there was still a lot of family relationships. And I would read all the battle reports in the Daily Telegraph every day and try and read background articles on the personalities and the politics that were involved. Yeah, I was a pretty unusual high schooler.
So what was going on in what was then Rhodesia at the time?
Well, not to bore you with too much detail, but basically there was a white colonial elite that was fighting to stay in power. They had unilaterally declared independence from Great Britain at a time when Great Britain was moving towards giving independence to its colonies and introducing black majority rule. And the white settlers obviously didn't want any of that. So they established their own regime, and most of the black population didn't like that, and eventually a rebellion sprang up. Opinion in the UK was pretty divided where I was growing up between people who were obviously on the side of justice and the black liberation struggle, and then those who had some more sympathy, say, ethnically with the what one paper called our kith and kin, the white elite fighting to cling on to power.
So what was Robert Mugabe's role in that liberation struggle?
Well, he was one of the leaders, not necessarily the primary leader, at least initially. There were two main rebel groups, which very, very broadly broke down along ethnic lines between the majority Shona people and the minority Ndebele people. And Mugabe clawed his way up to seize control of the Shona-dominated party, ZANU, the Zimbabwe African National Union. And when the rebel groups combined in an alliance called the Patriotic Front, they were able to basically bring the regime to the negotiating table.
So when Rhodesia became Zimbabwe and became independent in 1980, how come Mugabe got to be the one to be the president?
Well, he's a wily political operator, and he knows how to he maneuvered himself to get the actual executive power in the new constitution, initially as prime minister. And he installed a bit of a non-entity as president, and his main rival had to take second place as a cabinet minister. And I remember the transition very clearly. We used to debate it every day, what was going on in my high school history class. I was about a senior at the time. And I was elated with the deal. There was this guy who was turning his back on the Marxist struggle to become this symbol of reconciliation, and there's an enormous amount of hope invested in Robert Mugabe. I remember my history teacher, dear old Mrs. Butler, my mentor in many ways, being much more skeptical and saying, you know, let's just wait and see what happens at the next elections in 4 years' time.
Yeah, so what happened? Was she justified in her skepticism?
Damn right she was. The arrests of prominent political rivals began in 1982. And then there were all kinds of stories coming out about the killings of dissidents through the 1980s, which were difficult to confirm and didn't get a lot of publicity. But pretty much since then, every Zimbabwean election has been marred by intimidation, fraud, corruption, lack of media freedom. So Mugabe became executive president in 1987, and Zimbabwe around that time effectively became a one-party state.
And during all this time, where was the U.S.? What was the U.S. position regarding Mugabe?
Well, the U.S. saw everything, the whole struggle, the liberation struggle and the post-independence settlement through the prism of the Cold War. You can remember this was independence came in 1980, and Ronald Reagan's only just coming to power. The Cold War is at its height. There are Marxist guerrilla movements threatening to take over many parts of Africa and other places in the world. Mugabe had embraced Marxism, and so there was a big concern that he could have gone in that direction. You think of the countries like near neighbors like Mozambique and Angola, which went full communist. You know, he did not. So there was kind of an acceptance of him in Washington as this middle road person. But, you know, eventually the whites, you know, despite the deal that had been reached at independence, were stripped of much of their land and the control of other economic resources. They were supposed to be distributed to veterans, but pretty much Mugabe and his cronies grabbed most of the best assets. But the economy collapsed, food production collapsed, there was hyperinflation and famine, even famine in some areas.
So it seems the headline is Mugabe is gone. What has really changed in your view? What's changed for you?
He's 93, but I wouldn't, even now, I'm not sure I would write him off completely.
Yeah, let's, that it seems.
Let's wait and see what happens. He's never been in this much trouble, but he's a wily political operator, and he's toughed out some incredible crises in the past.
The World's History Guy, Chris Wolf, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Marco.
The military in Zimbabwe has insisted that what's happening in the country is not a coup, no matter what it looks like. Made us think of all those times in some other countries in the past when you could tell that there'd been a coup by what was being broadcast on national TV and radio stations. So today, if you had tuned into Zimbabwe Broadcasting Corporation TV, you'd have heard this. Normal programming replaced by music, including songs like that one we just heard about the greatness of the nation, or this one, which references Zimbabwe's liberation struggle from the British. Of course, another sign that this is indeed a coup in Zimbabwe may be how the country's military has gone out of its way to deny that it is a coup, with news bulletins like this one.
The Zimbabwe Defense Forces says they wish to assure the nation that His Excellency the President, Comrade Robert Gabriel Mugabe, and his family are safe and sound.
A taste there of what TV and radio stations have been broadcasting today in Zimbabwe during what the military there assures us is not a coup. We'll see in the days ahead whether it is or is not. And that is our show for today from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. We're back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.